The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
I'm delighted we have one of Ireland's leading novelists with us. His new book is Night Boat to Tangier. Kevin Barry, do me a small favour. Start by reading a little bit of the book to us.
Chapter 1. Would you say there's any end in sight, Charlie?
I'd say you nearly have an answer to that question already, Morris.
Two Irishmen, somber in the dank light of the terminal, make gestures of long sufferance and woe. They are born to such gestures and offer them easily. It is night in the old Spanish port of Algeciras. Oh, and this is as awful a place as you could muster. You'd want the eyes sideways in your head. The ferry terminal has a haunted air, a sinister feeling. It reeks of tired bodies and dread. There are scraps of frayed posters, the missing. There are customs announcements, the narco trafficante. Blind man roils in night sweat and clicks his teeth to sell lottery tickets like a fat, rattling serpent. He's doing nothing for the place. The Irishman look out blithely at the faces that pass by in a blur of the seven great distractions. Love, grief, pain, sentimentality, avarice, lust, and want of debt.
You can keep going if you want.
I'd let you read that for ages, give us half an hour
instead of doing the interview.
The good news is I do my own audiobooks.
Yeah, I was just about to ask you, do you?
Always, I wouldn't let anyone else near them, yeah.
You shouldn't let anybody else near them.
I do myself, yeah. Especially if it's Cork City Voices.
Well, exactly. You nailed that, absolutely. In fairness to you, you've got that absolutely
nailed. The thing about a Cork accent, it's often not that strong. People overdo it when they're doing a Cork accent. And if you're actually walking around Pana in Cork, it can be mild enough, you know. It's just a little inflection here and there. A little bit of startle, surprise at the end of the sentence, you know.
It's very good for a man who... You live in Sligo now, don't you?
I live in a swamp in the lovely South County Sligo on Loch Arrow.
Okay. In a former... Which is as far removed from Cork City as
it
you
is.
Can imagine.
Yeah, a bit too far away because I love going back, but it's nice. There are no distractions from the work shed, you know.
Listen, go back to that book for me. Tell me what it's all about. We've got a taster of it, so tell us how it develops.
Since I lived in Cork late 90s, every kind of January, February, the cloud closes in on me in the winter. And I turn into what Donald Trump calls a low energy individual. And I've always loved going to Spain for a while in January and February, just sneaking off for a couple of weeks.
Fine for you.
Even a couple of months if I could afford it. And for years then I've been thinking, how do I write my Spain book? You know, how do I do the Spain novel? And I couldn't figure it out for a long time. And then one day I had a blinding flash of inspiration. I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll put two Cork fellas down in Spain and we'll be away in a hack, you know. So they're called Morris and Charlie.
They're not Cha and Maya though.
They're not, do you know what? They're not far from Cha and Maya in a weird kind of way. That's been lodged somehow in my subconscious for years.
There's probably a whole load of people listening to us going, what the hell are they on about Cha and Maya?
I know. Yeah. Explain to millennials, please.
There were two comedians, actors in Cork who had these characters which were famous from Hall's Pictorial Weekly back in the 1970s, but also would have done a little bit sort of
They would sit on a bench was the routine, wasn't it? And they'd have long conversations about kind of nothing and about everything at the same time. And they were kind of brilliant. And it was kind of like a light TV skit that was edging into Beckett kind of territory. Somebody has told me it's on YouTube. You can find Cha and Maya on YouTube. So.
But you're edging a little bit into Beckett territory here as well, aren't you? Two fellas sitting just waiting for something to happen.
Yeah, and you can't write that about two Irishmen waiting for something or for somebody without in some way nodding towards himself, you know. So I even gave one of them a kind of a derby hat, like the figure from Godot.
But yet it's very different.
It's very different.
I've interrupted you because you were about to explain what the premise of the story is.
Sure, yeah. They're in their early 50s. They're criminals. Their business was importing boatloads of hashish from North Africa to the west coast of Ireland all through the kind of 90s and early 2000s. But they're kind of superannuated now because the little feckers are all grown out in polytunnels. This is kind of the ongoing joke in the book. The lads are out of business. One of their daughters has gone missing and they're aware that she's been running around Spain with a crowd with dreadlocks and dogs and ropes. Crusties, as we used to call them back in the 90s. Our new age travellers, more politely. So they're down there looking for her and they've heard she'll be passing through the port of Algeciras. It goes back and forth between the past of their lives and criminal enterprises and the present moment. And it kind of moves along kind of light on the surface, I think. And I think there are a lot of laughs in the book, but As I was writing it, even, it became apparent to me that it's about a lot of darker stuff underneath. It's about grief, and it's about the sense of being superannuated. These guys thinking, you know, Jesus, the glory days are over and we're past our best. And what's next? Are we staring into the void?
See, your glory days are far from over. Have you hit into your 50s yet?
I'm perilously close. I'm about two weeks away from the big 5-0, from okay. Hawaii 5-0, you know, which is it's a hard one to ignore.
But you're nowhere near superannuated. I mean, you're getting better and better. And the one thing I have to say, which is brilliant, is that...
Tell me more.
You don't do the same thing each time. Yeah. I mean, that's what's great about this compared, you know, to back to Beetlebone or City of Bohan, which I absolutely loved.
Thanks.
You actually... Everything is different.
Yeah, I try to always remind myself that I should be having a good time when I go to my shed, because I'm not digging the roads and I'm not down a coal mine by the luck of God, you know. And it's I try to keep it fun for myself, and I don't want to go in and write the same book over and over again. So I try to keep it fresh and try.
Do your publishers ask you to do so? Well, or your agents say, like, you need to be doing that because there's a market there for a Kevin Barry book, something to follow on after that
in
one.
In fairness to them, they wouldn't ever put pressure on you like that. But if you were being purely canny about it and thinking in terms of marketing your work, you would be inclined to keep writing, say, a City of Bohan type book or so on again and again. But now I just get bored, and it's a very simple equation for me. If I'm not having a good time in the shed in Sligo, beloved reader at the far end of the process isn't going to be having a good time either. I try to make it fun and kind of enjoyable for myself, and try and take what abilities I have and kind of see if I can force them into slightly new and different directions each time out.
How long did it take to write that book?
It's quite quick as it goes. It was kind of inside a year, just under a year.
That's quick, because I mean, it's a thin volume, and you're trying to play with lots of different things, because it's very lyrical, which I think hopefully people have got the sense of listening to you reading the extract from it. There's also an element of sort of like a stage play about it as well.
Yeah, and I wrote a draft of it initially for the two of them. I was thinking this could be a play, but it quickly became apparent to me that there was so much backstory. Like, one of them has a dead eye and one of them has a bad leg, and I was writing, describing this, thinking, how did they end up like this? And I knew that then it needed the kind of space and the air of a novel to really open back into all the freight that was underneath these lives that had brought them to this point. But it's it was intense. I was really enjoying it, but I found I was my sleep was completely broken on it. I wasn't sleeping well, because I'd go to bed at night and I'd turn off the lamp, wrecked, and immediately I'd start getting loads of Morris and Charlie dialogue going around the head. So I tried a new thing. I started working at night. And Olivia would go off up to bed with her book at 11 o'clock, and I'd start writing. Then I'd go till 3 or 4 in the morning, quite happily, you know, working away in the small wee hours up in Sligo.
And then sleeping on late the following day? Or
about
just 4 getting
o'clock,
up again?
About 4 o'clock, I'd pour a glass of red wine about the size of my head, and I'd sip at that for an hour. Then I'd sleep from kind of 5 till 9 or 10. And it's amazing that literally the day I finished the book and sent it off to the editors, 8 hours again a night, not a bother, you know. It's amazing how...
Does the sleep deprivation help, do you think, to sort of the imagination?
Almost every writer I know of is an insomniac at some level, you know. It is something. You're dealing with stuff that you're kind of... You get your material, you're sitting it back on your kind of subconscious at the back of your mind, and it kind of, you know, you're a bit wired from it. The only thing in life that writing is close to is dreaming. You're operating from the same place in your brain, you know. And when you think about it, when we dream, we're all brilliant storytellers. Everything works out, you know, in perfect narrative sense in our dreams, and the dialogue is great. And then we wake up and we can't do it. And it's what you're trying to do as a writer is you're trying to channel back into that dreamy kind of place where stories
and when you're writing, can you actually keep up with your imagination? If you're dreaming this dialogue, can you get it down on the page?
Do you know what?
That's quickly.
It's a really interesting question. Sometimes it almost seems like there's too much fluency. And it's coming too quickly. What I sometimes do is I switch to writing in longhand, and that kind of slows it down to kind of a useful degree sometimes. It's very important for me as well to act it out and to actually do it aloud and to do all the voices and to kind of do all the actions, you know. And that's part of the play of it as well, and part of the fun of it. Because it's amazing how well your ear will catch your evasions on the page, where you're kind of trying to go away from the story, or you're not really getting into the meat of it. Your eye will glaze over that quite happily on the screen or on the page, but as soon as you hear it out loud, you go, "Oh, hang on, you're not really doing this part justice at all." You know, you need to go in here deeper. You need to go in harder and really get at the meat of the story. And a very curious thing when you read back over your own stuff, over your own writing, really important thing to look out for is embarrassment.
Embarrassment? Why?
Yeah, when you read something on the page you've written and you recoil in horror, go, "Jeez, I didn't," you know, that's the good stuff. you know, cut everything else. It's the stuff that really embarrasses you and makes you flinch. That's when you're getting at the real heart of it. That's when you're getting
Why? Explain that to me a bit more.
I think it's because, you know, it's very easy as a writer to find yourself trying to sound wise on the page or trying to sound clever or on some sort of an elevated plane. But it's when you're really down in the murk of your own emotions and using the stuff from your own life and from your own past history, that's when it gets hard to look at what you're putting on the page. And you have to kind of, and it takes a while, Matt, over the years, I think, you have to develop a thicker skin. And I think very often in a writing career, there's this kind of circular motion where you're years homing in on your own fundamental kind of material, you know? Like when I was in my 20s trying to write fiction, I was trying to write books set in Butte, Montana and all kinds of crazy stuff, you know. It took me a long while to go, hang on, I have stuff closer to home that I can go in at.
Which you have done exceptionally well in recent years. You're living now in Sligo. You're there a while. You've done the last couple of books from there as well, haven't you?
Yeah, we've been there since 07, so 12 years now in Sligo.
The isolation, does that help you? Because you are in a remote rural part of Sligo, aren't you?
Yeah, we're in Ballinafad and Lough Carrow. It's a beautiful place. It's a beautiful place 10 months of the year. January and February isn't great. But yeah, I like it. You know, I look out the window now at the shed, and it's, you know, it's a lake, and it's green hills, and it's cows,
and nothing happens.
It's very quiet. You know,
the amazing. So does that leave your imagination run riot, almost to compensate for the stillness and the quietness of where you are?
It does. It's a kind of, you kind of, I guess, have the sense of a kind of a blank canvas, you know, and you can just kind of invent at will. I mean, I go out on the bike on a around Lough Carrow, and I'd say on a weekday morning, on a Tuesday or Wednesday morning, and you can go for 2 hours and not see a car. You know, and it's glorious that sense, you know, geez, I have the world to myself here.
You clearly don't suffer from loneliness.
No, I do find it's good to get out, you know, now and again, and to travel a bit and to go around and to see people and see cities and streets and pigeons eating fags at the side of the road. That can be good every now and again as well, you know. But it's mostly it's a lovely place for a writer to be based. Yeah, I'm very fond of it now. I'd find it. It took me a while. I grew up in the suburbs in Limerick and I lived in cities for years. It took me a while to get used to living in the country. You know, it's very dark at night. There are strange rustlings from the ditches. So it takes.
What persuaded you to do that? To give up city living?
Well, Olivia and I came back from the UK in, I think it was 06, height of the boom time. And we realised, you know, we're not going to be able to afford to buy a house in Dublin or in Cork. And someone said, Leitrim is cheap. Someone said to me, Leitrim is cheap. Go up and have a look at Leitrim. And we eventually found a place in County Sligo. And yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Often.
Do you know somebody who. Clearly, do you miss not being close to cinemas, theatre, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I don't chain myself to the radiator up there all the time. I do get down to towns. Now again, we'd often be down in Galway or down in Dublin, but it's mostly now I'm happy enough to drift around up there, and I find it's it's an interesting thing in a writer's life. Sometimes the decisions you make that don't seem to be about the work at all really end up influencing the work, and where you live is going to feed into the work in lots of different ways. And I have found when I write short stories now, they're very often set in the kind of interior northwest, and they're getting kind of closer to home and closer to the house all the time. Where you base yourself, it's one of the most critical artistic decisions you can make in a weird way, you know?
I'm going to leave it there. It's a fantastic new book, Night Boat to Tangier. Kevin Barry, great as ever meeting
Cheers,
you here
Matt.
In the programme. Thanks very
thanks.
Much. And by the way, if you enjoyed Kevin reading at the start of this interview, you can hear him reading at the Dalkey Book Festival this weekend. And he's at various festivals over the next 6 weeks in Belfast and West Cork. And he'll also be speaking in Hodges Figgis in Dublin and Waterstones in Cork City, where he'll be reading from his fantastic new book, Night Boat to Tangier.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.